You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space, a monthly podcast of artist talks, panel discussions, and other events.
Tēnā tātou katoa. Nau mai hoki mai ki tēnei kaupapa kōrero o the Physics Room. Nau mai, whakarongo mai, whakatau mai. My name is Abby Kinane, and I'm the director of the Physics Room, an art space dedicated to developing and promoting contemporary art and critical discourse in Aotearoa. Based in central Ōtautahi since 1996, we assist artists with resources and opportunities to enable creative and professional development and work to support the acknowledgement and understanding of contemporary art among New Zealanders. Our goal is to actively seek links between the arts and other areas of cultural production, and to involve art as a contributing voice in wider intellectual, social, and political debate. In this episode of Art, Not Science, I talked to Rachel Shearer about the 7-channel sound installation, Te Huri Wai, that she made in collaboration with Kathy Livermore for our current exhibition, Light Enough to Read By. We are also lucky to be able to share a single-channel version of the work in this episode as well. In this work, each of the principal Waitaha winds announce themselves. Te Huri Wai is made in acknowledgement of the kaitahu narrative of these winds, with particular reference to the record of Tione Tari Tikau's conversation with Heres Beattie in 1920. Tikau speaks of the ancestors of Maui, starting with his grandfather, Mahuika, on land, and Muri Raka Whenua, at sea, who married Hine Pū Nui o Toka and had 5 daughters, Hine Aroraki, Hine Aroaropari, Hine Hauone, Hine Roroki, and Hine Rōtia. Tikau writes, "These wahine still hold important positions in connection with this world. They are in the points of the wind and stand at points round the world and hold or loose the principal winds. The mother holds Te Pū or Te Hau, the power of the wind, generally, but her own particular position is in the southwest, where she holds Te Pū or Te Toka, the origin or beginning of the southerly winds. Accordingly, others hold responsibility for the northerly, westerly, and easterly winds, holding the sands, echoes on the cliffs. The eldest, Hine Aroraki, is responsible for the soaring of the birds. Tikau says that each of these winds holds a big tā whiriwhiri, a fan, which he uses to fan winds over the earth. But what these fans are made of, I know not." In the work, the speakers are cited in relation to each wind's direction. Livermore's voice or breath, ho, wind, vitality, holding the narrative. A further speaker holds the place of water, a relationship fundamental to each of the winds. In Livermore's words, winds are what move the water, the weather. In this work, warm breath is returned to the oral account, and the names of the area's winds are called out, listened for, and heard. Te Huri Wai transforms the gallery, along with other works in the exhibition by Fiona Connor and Lucy Skaya, each turning to narrative as to oxygen, light, matter, as necessary. Light Enough to Read By emerged from discussions around the return of the Physics Room's library into the gallery and to public access. In recent years, since the shift to our current site in the Registry Editions Building, our publications have sat in boxes. The specific needs of the library, sufficient and natural light, space for reading, listening, resting and being together, offered a script for us to work with in the development of this project. Underpinning it was the idea of the exhibition itself as a form of publication, and text or narrative as something social, material and lived, subject to conditions of light and weather. You can read more about the exhibition and the artists on our website at www.physicsroom.org.nz. And now, let's head into the gallery to hear from Rachel about Te Huri Wai. Kia ora mai tātou. Nau mai hoki mai ki the Physics Room. Welcome back to the Physics Room. It's so nice to see lots of you that seen around, and I'm especially grateful for you coming this weekend when I know there's a lot on, so it means a lot to have you here for some listening time with our amazing artist Rachel Shearer. Rachel is part of this exhibition we just opened a couple of days ago, Light Enough to Read By. I'm very happy to have an artist there. The other, Fiona Connor, is in Los Angeles at the moment. This is her work that we're sitting in. Lucy Skaya, whose work is on the ground there, is in Glasgow. And Kathy Livermore, who's a collaborator with Rachel on the piece we're going to talk about today, is in Tāmaki. But it's so good to have you here today, Rachel. And yeah, thank you for coming down. Thank you for what you're going to share. I also want to acknowledge Michelle Wang and Hamish Peterson, who have curated this exhibition with me. So we've been a power team for this project. So yeah, to start off, I met Rachel, when did I meet you? Some time ago. The first time I was really spent time with Rachel's work was at St. Paul Street Gallery at AUT University. It was the project near, was it in the middle of your PhD?
Yeah, it was kind of a test.
Yeah. That project was called Earth Music, and basically it was taking recordings of many of the sounds or the voices from the natural environment that was configured into quite an amazing immersive piece that was in the concrete space of that gallery. It was a really incredible work that I spent quite a bit of my summer with, actually, in this dark space with an incredible work by Rachel. But so I was super happy to be able to invite Rachel to work with her again for this project, particularly when I reached out. I mean, we were drawing on the idea of working through the exhibition as a publication or a text, thinking about different types of texts, different types of reading. And as our conversation progressed, thinking about types of reading that weren't contingent upon words or written words or the sort of traditional forms that we might associate with reading. And I knew Rachel and secondarily Kathy were really interesting people to put some of those questions to, the ideas of what it might mean to read in ways that relate more to understandings of the body or the environment around us or the weather and the systems that we find ourselves within. So I might hand over to Rachel to talk a bit about this piece, talk about who you are, where you're from, all of the things. Thank you again.
Yeah, no, kia ora Abby. Kia ora everyone. Kia ora koutou. Ngā mihi nui kia koutou. Thanks for coming along here. I've got a little of a list of things to go through. I might not touch them all, but we'll see. So I've got, first on my list, mihi. So I guess kind of coming up to today, it's been quite busy and kind of getting the install sorted and, you know, thanks to Hamish and Michelle and Audrey and Abby and all the work that you've all done and getting this together, pre-getting the speakers up, so then it's kind of arriving and then trying to get it all happening. And I've been thinking quite a lot about decolonised spaces lately. I teach up at AUT and we're looking at redesigning our program and thinking about, you know, what does a decolonised program look like? What are these decolonised spaces? And thinking about it in different ways. And I've been working with Mai Iwi, Rung Whakaata, and looking at different, I guess, different ways to think about going about that. And one of the things that we've been talking about is, you know, in front of the marae, the paipai, you know, the space that you go through over, you know, in the pōhiri process. And that's the domain of tūmā tōinga, tōinga. So tū, a kind of a ātua of war. But not so much war, that's where you're all kind of checking each other out and there's kind of a, I guess, a kind of a space of working out what the relationship is. And then once you get inside the whare, the space, and this is the space of rongo. And that is where, I guess, wānanga and knowledge and listening, so rongo, whakarongo, or, you know, whakarongo, to be like rongo, the ātua, who is, well, of the kūmara, but of course you couldn't grow kūmara unless things were very peaceful, so he's associated with peace as well. So whakarongo, to be like rongo, to listen. But it's not just to listen with your ears, it's to listen with everything, to listen with all your senses except for your eyes. Yeah, I think about being in that space of whakarongo, having been through two with all the opening and getting everything done, and then I feel like I'm finally kind of getting into this space of rongo in here where I can sort of sit back and listen to the work. And rongo, listening, is what my practice is all about.
I think we're talking the other day and you made the connection to rongo whakaata, to your iwi. Do you mind just touching on that?
Yeah, so if I kind of start with Māori styles, you know, kind of getting the bigger context, and this one it's kind of like who I am and my practice, and then coming down to the point or the focus, which is the work. So my family, he Uriaho, Nō Te Waka Hirauta, so the Hirauta Waka came to the East Coast. And is associated with my family's iwi, rongo whakaata. So rongo, again, and whakaata is to show. So it's the idea that we're kind of listening and then you express it. So that goes with the name rongo whakaata. On my dad's side, actually I just found out, I didn't know my dad's family, but I finally found out where my name Shearer came from. They're from Ireland, and they arrived on the Te Waka, Auckland, in Port Chalmers. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So And I could see all their names. It was a whole family of brothers called Shearer and all their wives and children. And they were all farm labourers. So, yep, they were shearers, probably. Yeah. And they all came from County Antrim near Belfast.
Mm.
So Port Charm is where actually where I spent quite formative years and where I did really establish my sound practices, kind of early sound practices. I moved down there at a young teenager and lived flatted with other people who were playing experimental music and flatting with Bruce, who had Expressway at the time, and collaborated with artists like Stella Corkery and Michael Morley. So these were very formative years playing music.
Mm.
So little did I know, I've been back since and visited all the gravestones of my great-great-grandparents. So, I only just found out last year who they were and where they were. So that was kind of a nice, nice little kind of poetic hook-up. So from there, Elam Art School, a bit of expanded cinema, but because I played music, I kind of became the default sound person and it just kind of like built on from there. I had a great occasion where I went to a music industry event and they had to answer a questionnaire and I won the prize. It was $10,000 worth of musical equipment and and that set me up with my first studio, which I took with me to Germany. I had an opportunity to go and work with Germany with a sound engineer called David Peterson, who's from here. He was the original Gordon sound man. He's actually from Ashburton, but then he moved up here with them, and so this was his stomping ground. He actually died at the end of the last year, on the last day.
Mm.
And so, me here to David.
Mm.
He was... taught me most of my sound skills, which I've been able to build on since. So, sorry, unexpected emotional moment there.
No, it's understandable. When was it that visual things, I mean, you talked about expanded cinema, but when you went to Elam, for example, did you have a visual practice? Did you go there to work in sound primarily?
A bit of both. That was when Phil Dadson, he had the intermediate department, so I was working with Phil. So it was very much about bringing in all these different aspects of performance and sound and image, and I thought I'd just go there and experiment. Was playing, you know, performing and using, like lots of people were, projections. Yeah, it was just kind of playing around with forms of that, but yeah, did a lot of Super 8 work and playing around with sound and image. But when I was over in Germany and I'd taken all the gear that I'd won, and that was kind of, I moved into a project called Lovely Midget, and that was me kind of learning how to use all this equipment as well. And that's when I experienced quite a shift with sound, because so before that it had been kind of more of a social thing in many ways. And there, learning sound engineering, it became very much sound as a physical material. So that was kind of a shift in things. Coming back here, I moved deeper into sound tech type stuff, post-production audio, live sound, composing for film, public installations, sound installations, a lot of long-term installations with solar-powered speakers. So... yeah, and throughout making music as well and just kind of developing my craft as I get older.
Do you see a distinction between your sort of music practice as a musician and then this like sound artist? Like I know they're just labels, but do you just feel you can move quite fluidly between those things?
Yeah, it's just always just a kind of slight contextual shift.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. Now I'm moving into, apart from, sort of practice-wise, sonification. So I did do, I'm just about to head into talking about this work actually. Mm. Maybe I'll talk about that and then add on what I was going to say. So just in terms of being invited here, and I know Abby that you like the work that I'd done with Kathy, which was a surround sound piece that was exploring Te Reo Māori. So this is kind of Kathy and I have this collaboration that's really about kind of sound and exploring Te Reo Māori and sound and movement in Māori, frameworks.
And the materiality, I was so drawn.
This
is in a piece you can listen to online called Te Oro or Te Ao that Rachel made alongside her PhD thesis. And the work I was so fascinated by was about the crystal becoming Pounamu. And
other way
around. Oh, Pounamu becoming crystal, sorry. Yeah. I thought of it before when you said the idea of sound becoming something really physical. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's exactly my experience in listening to that work. I was like, oh, yeah, it's about geology and it's about these, like, states of transformation of material. And I guess moving here as well, I was thinking about Ponamu as being something of this place. And so, yeah, that was another reason when I reached out, I was like, what about this Ponamu work? Like, I'd heard it in Auckland and I hadn't really thought about it being site specific. It had a new resonance being here as well for me.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt there.
No, not at all. Doing the PhD was a good opportunity to kind of focus on this idea of the materiality of sound, and it was really focused on listening to the earth through Māori and Western frameworks. And I guess the Western frameworks, there's kind of a deep listening, Pauline Oliveros, there's field recording, there's a real richness of stuff. And then in terms of the Māori framework, something interesting that came out is that all sounds, you know, they don't make sounds, they all have a voice, the voices of the earth, I guess. And inevitably, when you're listening to the earth as well, it's, you know, issues of the climate crisis and things come in there as well. So there's kind of an unspoken reference here to that as well, with the water and then with the winds as well. And, you know, winds and water are, you know, they're kind of the key elements of the weather.
Mm.
Yeah. So through that also I started these conversations with Kathy, and these have been a series of works that have come through that, and this is an extension of that. And also Kathy is from here, so she'll be coming back at another stage and she'll be able to build on all this kōrero. But I was wanting to do something that was really specific to here, tell a story that was specific to this part of the country. And, you know, it just so happens that Kathy's from here as well. She is Waitaha, Kaitahu, Kati Mamoe. So these winds, the story here is a whakapapa of the weather, and Kathy whakapapas to here, and whakapapas to where the story comes from. So this is part of the connection and of her being within this.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
I might actually just read, instead of recounting the story, it's just a little section in this book, Tikal Talks. So Tione Tare Tikal, he is a rangatira, tohunga of repute, one of the last to go through the old school of learning. But he does say that, you know, they're meant to have reached their full learning by the time they are about 14 or 15, but his teachers died when he was 11 or 12, so he didn't get that last little bit of learning, but he was one of the last ones to go through with the old teachers. So every now and then in the book he'll go, and that's all I know, the story will stop because he didn't get the last little bit. But this particular whakapapa, the story of these winds, they're Maui's aunties. Yeah, so this is the whakapapa of Maui. So, Mahuika, his maternal grandfather, had a twofold existence, being called Mahuika on land and Muri Raka Whenua at sea. One of his two gigantic bodies dwells in the water and the other lives on shore as fire, or as the guardian of fire. Now he married Hine Pu Nui O Toka. So this is the wind. They were aligned with the compass, best we could. So coming from the south, so it's really nice that there's this window here as well, because this is the mother and she's the most powerful wind as well, coming in from the south, Hine Pu Nui O Toka. And they had a family of five girls. Yep, and these are our other winds that are here. And there was Hine Aroraki. Now Hine Aroraki actually is Maui's mother. And Hine Aroraki is the atua, or the deity ancestor, of the soaring of birds. So that's the wind that she controls. And then there's Hine Aro Aro Pari, controls the echoes on the cliffs. And Hine Ho'one is on the edge of the sand, controls the sand, and is from the west to the north, coming over this way, angled over there. And we've got Hine Roroki, so the northerly, over in the corner over there, and Hine Rōtia, a westerly. So there's a map, I think, in there, yeah, if you're interested in coming back and kind of mapping all their different directions as part of their story. He says here, this was right away in the beginning of things, so early that I do not know if Tiri Tawhiri Mātia had as yet exercised any control over the wind. So I don't know if you know any, but the whakapapa of Rangi and Papa in Tawhiri Mātia was one of the children who was, you know, supposedly the atua of the winds. Yeah, Kathy's actually got more about this. And from her point of view, there's kind of, there's eel, you know, who comes before everything else, before the darknesses, all the periods of nothing. And this whakapapa, Maui's whakapapa, comes direct from eel, so it doesn't go through Rangi and Papa. So that's why there's these separate you know, winds.
Mm. And Kathy's kōrero as well brings in a lot more about the water, eh? About Wainuiatia and the why, the big
absolutely
grandfather water as well.
It's quite funny because I'm working on another work at the moment, which is based down here. This is with Alex Monteith, who's been working with different museums down in Dunedin and Christchurch as well. And there's all this kind of footage about water, and it's so funny because I keep finding myself in these conversations about who's more important, the wind or the water. And it came up with this one as well, because Kathy had kept on going, "You're talking about the wind too much. It's all about the water." The water comes first. And in fact, in the Te One Te Kau story, that's when he talks about that. He talks about it as being flat but fat. Yeah, so it wasn't flat like a saucer, but yeah, kind of.
Like a bowl.
Like a bowl. He talks like a saucer full of water with sand around the end. But the water was always there. And so this is the kōrero that Kathy keeps coming back to, yeah, is the importance of the water.
Can you talk about how the winds move the...
And the winds move the water, that's yeah, right. The weather is being this kind of combination of the kind of the water and winds, and how integral the air is in the way that the water, you know, becomes mist and winds and rains and that combination of those elements.
And Te One Te Kau says the wahine that move the wind, they move it with big tawhiriwhiri, like with these big fans.
Yeah.
But something, I think it's one of these moments where he says, that's what they do, but I don't actually know how.
Yeah.
It's sort of like this ellipsis in the story where he didn't learn everything.
Yeah. It says, each wind goddess holds a big tawhiriwhiri fan, which she uses to fan the winds over the earth, but what the fans are made out of, I know not.
Yeah. I love that in a story when it's like, it's a narrative, it's like collectively shared, and it's very old, but there's also things that we can't, that aren't known, or the narrative is not this sort of continuous linear form. It actually has these moments where like he can't explain everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea with these elements that we're trying to tell with the story is to kind of give you enough to kind of, yeah, an idea of the story, a kind of a shape of the whakapapa. And also ho, the word ho, is important here, because ho can be translated as it's a breath. Ho is also the wind. But ho is also a vital essence, but like Modi, they kind of work in with each other. So, you know, the body being made out of, we have our kind of physical tinana, we have a Modi, a kind of a life force, and ho is a wairua, a spirit, and ho being this kind of vitality, this essence. So ho is a kind of a key word in how the story is told, yeah, as well.
Can you just talk a bit about the practical process, or the process of you and Kathy working together? Like, yeah, how that, I know you've worked together a bit in the past and you're like mates,
yeah,
but how did it actually, yeah, how did you guys share the story and divide up the sort of labour of making the work?
Yeah, so once we'd kind of got some of these ideas, we were kind of back and forth with this particular story and how the water would be incorporated as well. Kathy came in and performed in the studio, and that was quite an interesting process because Kathy's a dancer and a performer, and she kind of goes into a zone, and it was really interesting. I thought, let's just do this all in one take. We can just kind of go through all the different winds. And it was really interesting that she kind of physically changed as she got on to the next one, and her voice changed as well. So it was, really interesting process. Mm. She leaves that with me. I play around and do the sound editing, sound design. But then I'd go back with her and I'd talk about the placing and the order, and we'd just kind of play around with that a bit. So mapping out the space, which we did. And so I'd go back and Kathy and I pored over the map and worked out how we might prepare the space. Mm. Yeah, so a bit of back and forth, but yeah, mostly all technical stuff is all left to me.
Mm. Mm. Yeah, it's super interesting to me, like working on this show, I've learned so much about this room, which is something you always, I guess, like learn about making any exhibition, the sort of material properties, the acoustic properties, all the materials you have to deal with. But this has, for me, been an exhibition where it's looked outward a lot as well, like in really literal ways, like Fiona Connor and Lucy Skaya proposed to cut these or reveal these windows that were in the existed in the structure of the building, but they've been kind of erased to make the perfect kind of white cube that lots of exhibitions rely on. And also to take off the doors of the workshop to kind of reveal the inner workings of the gallery in that way, and take the vinyl off the back the back window. So there's a lot more, like the space suddenly feels a lot more porous and a lot more like connected with what's going on outside. And then in the sort of inverse of that, bringing the hoe or the winds in here. And yeah, Rachel and I spent a couple of months ago, spent quite a long time on a cold morning playing with our iPhones with the compass directions, which we're not agreeing between two iPhones, to figure out the way that these winds were located. So I guess it's been a really interesting exercise in recognizing how the gallery, how all of us are interconnected with a lot of much larger systems, a kind of liveness in the space, which has been an amazing thing to kind of learn and think through. Yeah. I was wondering, maybe we'd listen through a cycle of the work and then we can take some questions after that if you'd like to, or it can just sort of, yeah, we can just move into a different sort of space.
Thank you.
Does feel like a space of the wrong way now.
Yeah. I'd love to open up some questions if anyone has them. Before that, I just want to say thank you for your work on this and for me, anyway, helping to make me so much more aware of the place in which I am, of the surroundings, which I do relate to sort of a type of reading experience, that real attentiveness. Sometimes it is with your eyes and your brain, but sometimes it's like this listening with the whole body, which, yeah, it's been a really amazing experience working with you, so thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You are listening to Art Not Science, presented by the Physics Room Contemporary Art Space.
Does anyone have anything they'd like to say? Or sing, or, you know.
The book that you referred to, Daniel, is that in the library?
I think there's often multiple copies in all libraries. This one that's called Treasures from the Ancient World of the Māori, and I've got another copy that says Tales of the Canterbury Māori. So, yeah, some fantastic stories in there.
There's something like 16 copies in the library. And also, we saw in the urupa out at Rāpaki, at the church there, that's where he's buried, so I saw his gravestone the other day. It's like a very local person.
Yeah, and then one of his phenomena, obviously.
At the church at Rāpaki, out
at Littleton.
Yeah.
Died in 1927, is that right?
Yeah, not so long after that story, so it's really interesting that that happened. Yeah.
I have a technical question. That beautiful rain recording, is that a recording that you made, and if so, where?
So that is a combination of different places. I've got a hydrophone, buried that in the sand, just near the shore, so there's that kind of click, click, click. Yeah, so that's kind of the water and the sand that's kind of rubbing past it. Not actually any rain in there, but it's interesting how white noise can be all sorts of things. But yeah, mainly that kind of, that texture is kind of sand and water running past the hydrophone. Yeah.
A similar question from me is, how did you record the wind sounds that are coming out of the main speaker here?
Wind is really, really hard to capture. Yeah. So they're very elusive. That's why they're saying their names rather than me trying to. Yeah. But also, I guess we wanted them just to claim the space. So it's just that idea of the, especially in Te Ao Māori, you know, the power of the name and the spoken word as well. So for them, claiming their space. Yeah.
I found they make you move your body quite a lot as well, because we were trying to listen to, they're obviously orientated really specifically, and then trying to hear where the sound's coming from. And of course, it is a material thing that's like bouncing off these different surfaces. But I found myself like being steered by the work. It was quite interesting. You do this strange little dance in the middle of the space when you're trying to follow it. Yeah, which is an interesting thing for a narrative to do, like physically make you shift. Yeah.
But to answer your question, there are some winds up here, but not down there. That's all water and a lot of processing. You do a lot of kind of, you know, digital fiddling. But with those winds, the good winds is actually the sound of the objects that they're blowing through rather than the actual kind of wind itself. So, yeah, it's out the back of my place. There's a good stand of bamboo. So, I mean, they click a bit, but if you get the bits where you don't get the clicking, you get some quite nice sound of the wind coming through there. But you do have to kind of tidy it up and roll off certain frequencies to get the kind of the cliche, you know, the sound that we hear with our ears. Yeah.
With the nor'wester, is that over there, like the sort of like predominant Canterbury wind? Do you know which one that relates to?
Yes, so this is this one over here, which is Hūone. Oh. Yeah, so apparently according to Kathy, and this was kind of completely unrelated, and she had this kind of a list of winds, and there was one particular healing wind, which she reckoned was the one that came from the west to the northwest. Right. And is it northwest to northwest? East to north, yeah, east to north. Mm-hmm. Yeah, is that what you were talking about? What did you say? Yeah.
Just when people say the nor'wester, this is like intense, crazy, warm, up and moving wind.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's Hūone.
So I'm just thinking, because our westerly is Rōtia, actually. Mm-hmm. So Hūone goes east to north. Yeah. So westerly towards the north, it would be Hine Rōtia. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
Hey, so maybe we bring things to a close. Oh, you have a question.
It's not really a question, but just a thank you. And maybe more of a question for the room. Because I felt like a temperature change in me as I heard the different winds from different directions, and I was really quite astounded by that in the way that people have been using their voice to capture that change, and I just wanted to know if anyone else felt it.
Cold breezes across my skin really strongly.
Yeah, awesome.
Quite like it's really embodied.
Yeah, I hadn't quite connected like the sound of temperature. Yeah.
Mm. Nice idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I had a short question. I was reading a book that Gertrude lent me about a writer was talking about her experience of teaching writing. And she said that in all her years of doing it in these writing programs, the only people who exhibited a, what she said, superhuman power of listening as students were dancers. And I've been thinking about that a bit over the last couple of weeks, and I was wondering, and then I was thinking about your relationship with and work with Kathy. Just wondering if you could talk a bit about that as, you know, working with her as a dancer and listening.
Absolutely. Our conversations really came out of talking about sound and movement, how that kind of whole idea of, you know, the becoming and the unfolding of whakapapa and sound and movement as being this that relationship, more kind of exploring the idea. And that idea of whakarongo, of listening with your body as well. So that's definitely something that Kathy works with and is very sensitive to, which is why she's been such a great collaborator, that we've kind of been able to talk about sound through these different kind of senses and stories. Yeah, Kathy would have a lot of interesting stuff to say about that specifically, so come back when she's down here.
Mm, yeah, we're just finalising the date, but the conversation we had, it linked really directly to what you said about ho being something like an internal vitality or breath, but also the wind ho, and then Kathy also brought in the water, the idea of the waters that are in us and then the waters that have brought us here or that we move through.
Yeah.
So that sort of, I don't know, like micro, macro relational thing, dynamic that's happening between wind or breath and water.
Yeah. I mean, the other thing is, you know, the wiri, the kind of foundation of Māori performance art and that being a kind of also described as the tremble of life. And so there's that kind of nice relationship between, I guess, the performing arts and te ao Māori and this idea of the tremble of life and, of course, vibration being fundamental to sound, talking about sound, the physics of sound as well. So, yeah.
Well, the sneeze.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's have a clap.
Right. I just got a little song. So just Māori styles. I'll finish off with a song. This one's actually written by my cousin, so it's specific to my whānau up there on the in the East Coast. But this, I guess, is for me to call out to these ātua, but also to my tīpuna. So I'll stand up for that. It's only a section of it, so sorry. Rachel, my cousin's Rachel as well, Rachel Aroha. So kia ora, Rach, for the song. Kē te karanga mai, ngā tīpuna. Kē te re reino, ngā roi mata. I te pūtake, o mano aru. I te pārenga, o te arai. Nō reira, e te whānau, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou katoa.
That was Rachel Shearer talking about her sound installation made with Kathy Livermore. We hope you enjoyed listening to Te Huri Wai today, but be sure to come into the gallery to experience it in all of its seven-channel glory before Light Enough to Read By closes on Sunday the 25th of June. Thank you for listening, and tune in again next month on Friday 16th July at 8 p.m. for our next episode of Art Not Science. Ka kite anō.
The Physics Room is generously supported by Creative New Zealand, the Christchurch City Council, the Rata Foundation, Three Boys Brewery, Scientech, Resine Paints, and the Crater Rim.